exercise a right of ownership over inventions that they acquire through experimenting on people.
The earliest reported unethical medical trials on Africans by Westerners were sterilization tests done on Herero women by German doctors. The Herero and Nama genocide was a campaign of racial extermination and collective punishment that the German Empire undertook in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, against the Herero and the Nama people. It is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. It took place between 1904 and 1908. Despite being one of the richest countries in the world, Germany is yet to compensate the descendants of women who suffered unethical tests in the hands of German scientists during the colonial era. Why are Western countries refusing to take responsibility?
How can you understand that in France, you have people being paid to have babies, the government trying to encourage people to have babies, but at the same time, in some parts of France, because La Réunion is part of France, it's a kind of colony, you had people, or doctors, or scientists, sterilizing women against their will. So there's something wrong here. So if we want to compensate, to repair what was done in the past, we've got to stop what we are doing right now.
The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Trovan in Nigeria is cited as one of the outstanding examples of impunity by Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa. In 1996, Kano State in Nigeria suffered a major meningitis outbreak. Top United States pharmaceutical company Pfizer decided to conduct clinical trials to test a drug it was developing. Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa.
The drug had not yet been approved in the United States, where parents were not willing to put up their children as guinea pigs. Pfizer deliberately desisted from obtaining informed consent from the parents of the Nigerian patients. A Nigerian lawyer rejected the company's excuses that the studies were conducted through a deal with the Nigerian government.
At that time, the person, if there was any deal at all, was made by an individual against the interest of a government, against the interest of a nation. If you get what I'm saying? Now, forget about if any deal was done at all, it was individualistic deal. I don't want to hear about it. Pfizer ought to have known better. Can they do that deal in America? Can they do it in the UK or in any of the European countries?
No. Now, because of the adverse effects which the vaccine had on the children, including death and disabilities, the Nigerian federal government filed a suit against Pfizer and several of its employees in June 2007.
The government was seeking nearly $7 billion in damages for the deaths of children involved in the Trovan drug trial. In late January 2009, the Nigerian federal government informed the court that it has agreed with Pfizer to settle the lawsuit out of court.
We believe that the case that the federal government has against Pfizer is a good case. There's overwhelming evidence of Pfizer's misconduct. There's overwhelming evidence that Pfizer perpetrated all kinds of fraudulent activities and also engaged in this clinical trial illegally. There are victims who are living today. There are some families of the victims who have died who... What they understood at the time Pfizer came to Nigeria was that Pfizer was volunteering treatment. They did not think that they were volunteering their children as guinea pigs for a clinical examination.
In a move that surprised many, the parties agreed to a settlement figure of only $75 million. WikiLeaks cables suggest that Pfizer may have blackmailed the head of Nigeria's Ministry of Justice into dropping the multi-billion dollar criminal lawsuit. 24 years after the scandal, many victims are yet to be compensated and still can't live normal lives.
Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Do you think Western pharmaceutical corporations are taking advantage of poverty in some African countries by conducting unethical tests on their citizens?
are not really poor. Poverty is not, lack of food or lack of shelter. That is destitution. Poverty is redefined as lack of what the West has. So how they operate is not because Africans are poor, but because they change the definition of poverty. So that Africans will stop developing their own natural resources, will stop inventing what is relevant for them, will stop using their traditional and natural resources and knowledges to change their future, but instead wait for Western intervention to happen.
Thanks for that insight on destitution and poverty, Dr. Gelo. Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently raised concerns about the disinformation campaign and conspiracy theories circulating about COVID-19 vaccines.
While the country is in the process of procuring inoculations for its citizens as it fights the pandemic, anti-vaccine sentiments are being expressed by a number of people, including those in higher offices such as political leaders. Clearly, many Africans mistrust vaccines supplied by Western pharmaceutical companies, especially those that have a history of conducting unethical trials on Africans.
Dr. Gelo, is it true that incidents such as the Pfizer scandal in Kano, Nigeria, have led many to doubt even legitimate vaccines and thus negatively impacting on the overall health of the population?
That is a very good example, what happened in Nigeria on the Nigerian children who had meningitis by this big corporation, raises the alarm that, you know, Africans are genuinely justified to doubt and are justified to ask strong guarantees, strong commitment that they will be beneficiaries. These experiences show us that there is no genuine desire to solve the problem of life, to solve the problem of Africans. The greatest drive is actually to acquire profit, to make more money. So there is a primacy of profit over the value of life. Within this context, then Africans are really justified to doubt.
Last year, there were protests in South Africa when the University of Witwatersrand, in partnership with the Oxford University, rolled out South Africa's first clinical trial. Protesters say they did not want Africans to be used as guinea pigs, reflecting concerns among many in Africa over testing drugs on people who do not understand the risks.
I'm not happy at all. I mean, this feels like 1981 all over again, or in the 1980s all over again, when the AIDS pandemic just broke out in SA. It feels like the same thing. It's like a replay, but this time they're doing it in our face.
Mr. Traore, you earlier talked about vigilance in the face of unethical practices by Western pharmaceutical companies. Now, can you elaborate, especially in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine?
Keep on repeating it. Every bad thing that we do to African countries, okay, if it is accepted and if no one says anything, we are later going to do the same thing to our own population. So this is why we've got to be very vigilant, especially right now with the vaccines against COVID-19. Okay? So this is, we don't know what they have in their vaccines. We do not know. So I think, you know, when you have people in the world talking about reducing the population on Earth, you've got to be very vigilant.
In a very selfish move in June last year, the U.S. government bought up virtually all the stocks for 3 months of remdesivir, which has proven to work against COVID-19. This immoral and unethical decision by the U.S. left none for the rest of the world, including Africans who are involved in its clinical trials. Now, Dr. Gelo, we saw how the U.S. prevented African countries from obtaining remdesivir in the fight against COVID-19, yet Africans were used in its clinical trials. What's your view on this?
A lot of Africans from Liberia, from Guinea, from Democratic Republic of Congo were participating in experimental treatment for Ebola. So this medicine was administered to them, and it is by that participation, through that process, that this medicine became accepted as harmless for humans and can be used now for COVID-19. But what we see after all of this happened is the company that has sole ownership over this invention, the company called Gilead, has now the is kind of exercising the right to give patent to selected companies and countries, and it is really unlikely that Africans will have easy access to this medication.
Mr. Traore, some Africans are skeptical about COVID-19 vaccines being sourced from Western countries. Is there a reason to doubt these vaccines?
I think this is the West, and everyone loves Africa, but they do not love the Africans. So Africans have to be very careful with that. They have to be aware of that. So this is why this is a crime. We know that when you've got some Americans talking about the fact that there are too many of us on Earth, that we should limit or reduce the population on Earth, we know that the first target is the African continent. This is where you have all the resources.
Mr. Traore there believes that some of these COVID-19 vaccines are actually a ploy to wipe out Africans. What do you think? Let us know through our social media handle. Now, Mr. Gelo, you get to have the last word in our show today. Tell us, what should African countries do to prevent Western pharmaceutical giants from using the continent as a testing ground for their drugs?
People have become, disposables if they are not useful for the system. That autonomy which we envision through various kinds of mechanisms such as human rights and others are not really being observed because governments are not observing the dignity of human beings. They are interested rather in protecting the profits, property rights, patent rights of corporations and companies. And governments which are meant to serve their own population, especially the poor, are not carrying out their duties in the way they are expected according to these international agreements of human rights that they signed up to. So I think we need to come back to the human, to our own human sense of dignity, a dignity that we give to life, and respect that life is more important than profit.
Well, life is more important than profit. We hope governments and global multinationals will listen to that advice and stop exploiting people for profits. And with that, viewers, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Do let us know your opinion about our show. Your comments are of immense value to us. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. And until next time, goodbye and take care.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. President Joe Biden said on Friday, 5th of February, that he would bar his predecessor, Donald J. Trump, from receiving intelligence briefings traditionally given to former presidents, saying that Mr. Trump could not be trusted because of his erratic behavior even before the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David Sanger. The piece is titled, Biden bars Trump from receiving intelligence briefings citing erratic behavior. Stay with us for more of David E. Sanger's article. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Friday, 5th of February, that he would bar his predecessor, Donald J. Trump, from receiving intelligence briefings traditionally given to former presidents, saying that Mr. Trump could not be trusted because of his erratic behavior even before the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The move was the first time that a former president has been cut out of the briefings, which are provided partly as a courtesy and partly for the moments when a sitting president reaches out for advice. Currently, the briefings are offered on a regular basis to Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. President Biden, speaking to Nora O'Donnell of CBS News, said Mr. Trump's behavior worried him, unrelated to the insurrection that gave rise to the second impeachment of Donald Trump. I just think that there is no need for him to have the intelligence briefings, Mr. Biden said. What value is giving him an intelligence briefing? President Biden added, what impact does he have at all, other than the fact that he might slip and say something? The White House said this week that it had been reviewing whether the former president, whose impeachment trial in the Senate begins on Tuesday, should receive the briefings. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Adam Schiff, said last month, just before Joe Biden's inauguration, that Donald Trump's access to any classified information should be cut off. There is no circumstance in which this president should get another intelligence briefing, not now and not in the future, said Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, who was the House manager for Donald Trump's first impeachment trial a year ago. Adam Schiff added, indeed, there were, I think, any number of intelligence partners around the world who probably started withholding information from us because they didn't trust the president would safeguard that information and protect their sources and methods. Adam Schiff said, and that makes us less safe. We've seen this president politicize intelligence, and that's another risk to the country. The question of how former President Donald Trump handled intelligence came up several times during his presidency. Shortly after he fired the FBI director James Comey in 2017, Donald Trump told the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador to Washington about a highly classified piece of intelligence about ISIS terrorists that came from the Israeli regime. The Israelis were outraged by Donald Trump's actions. There were other examples, and Mr. Trump's aides later said that because he declined to read intelligence reports, preferring an oral briefing, he did not see the S and U markings that indicated secret and unclassified. But there was a deeper worry about how Donald Trump could use intelligence now that he has retreated to Mar-a-Lago, his club in Florida. The former president has talked openly about the possibility of running for the White House again, perhaps under the banner of a third political party. The fear was that he would use or twist intelligence to fit his political agenda, something he has often been accused of when in office. Among those arguing to cut off Donald Trump's access was Susan M. Gordon, a career CIA officer who served as deputy director of the National Intelligence until 2019, when she left after being passed over for director of National Intelligence. In an opinion article in the Washington Post in January, Susan Gordon, one of the most respected intelligence officers of her generation, wrote that the danger of providing intelligence to a president whose business deals might make him beholden to foreign investors and to lenders was just too great. Susan Gordon frequently briefed Donald Trump. His post-White House security profile, as the professionals like to call it, is daunting, Gordon wrote the week after the attack on the Capitol. Gordon added, any former president is by definition a target and presents some risk, but the former President Trump, even before the events of last week, might be unusually vulnerable to bad actors with ill intent.
Debate. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. In his first foreign policy speeches, President Biden said this war has to end, and to underscore the U.S.'s commitment, Washington would end all relevant arms sales to the Saudis. In reaction to the U.S. president's decision, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. The announcement also puts the spotlight on a major humanitarian crisis that the U.S. helped aggravate. The reversing of the policy also comes as a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, a major U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf region. The war, which has been accompanied by an all-out siege of the impoverished Arab country, has resulted in the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to reinstate former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi and suppress the Ansar Allah movement, who took control of the country after Hadi's resignation. The Saudi-led coalition expected to finish its job in weeks, but it has been nearly 6 years Riyadh and its allies are stuck in this quagmire. Since day one, the United States and some European countries have been supporting this war either by selling arms to the aggressors or by taking no action toward the crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. Washington also blacklisted the Ansar Allah movement and their supporters while they are defending their country against the aggression. Now the new U.S. administration apparently wants to have a different approach toward the war. In his first foreign policy speech on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. I've asked my Middle East team to ensure our support for the United Nations-led initiative to impose a ceasefire, open humanitarian challenges, and restore long-dormant peace talks.
Biden said he will end all American support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Yemen and will make sure humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. Nonetheless, the U.S. president also pledges support for Saudi Arabia to defend its sovereignty. Biden's remarks drew reaction from Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. An Ansar Allah spokesman said the only way to restore peace in Yemen is to stop the Saudi-led war and end the blockade. A senior Ansar Allah official also noted that any action without tangible results to end the war will be futile.
I think that Biden has realized
that the Saudi war on Yemen, like the Saudi war on Syria, has failed. And what might happen is that the Saudi regime, the monarchy, collapses. And that would be a disaster for the U.S. because it's one of the pillars of their domination of the Middle East. It's one of their main client states in the Middle East besides Israel.
According to the United Nations, the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused the world's biggest humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, while millions displaced since the war started in March 2015. Now that the new U.S. administration wants to show its goodwill and different policy from the previous one, the first step to end the war will be taking Ansarullah off Washington's so-called terror list. The world has to wait and watch how serious Biden is in his pledge of ending the war on Yemen and bringing peace to the impoverished Arab country.
Joining us on this debate, we have author of No More War, Mr. Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also from New York, we have author and activist Sarah Flounders. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war. Will he act on those comments? For example, will he actually sign the bill, the same bipartisan bill that the Senate tried to get past Donald Trump?
Well, all of that remains to be seen. First of all, obviously, those of us who care about peace, who care about human rights, welcome Biden's statement that he's going to end support of Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen. We've been pushing the U.S. to end its support for the Saudi war for some time. At the same time, the fact that he uses words like offensive operations while saying that he's going to still help Saudi Arabia with its defense and still help Saudi Arabia allegedly go after Al-Qaeda in Yemen, when in fact Saudi Arabia has been partnering with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, makes me wonder what the policy really is. I just think we don't know. Right now, he's put loopholes in big enough for a Mack truck to drive through. So I think the situation has to be monitored very, very seriously.
Sarah Flounders, the U.S. president said in a speech at the State Department that the war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Is that enough, though? Ending offensive support. Isn't it about time, in your opinion, for maybe a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one with less bombs and more aid and actual diplomacy?
Certainly. This is absolutely true, because it's semantics to say, well, we're going to end some offensive aid, and yet we're going to keep defending Saudi Arabia, really means that there's a backdoor in this that you could drive a truck through. If there's any sincerity, the first step is to absolutely end the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization label that they've put on the Ansarullah movement, on the Houthi movement, to immediately end the siege, to end the sanctions, to allow immediate aid to arrive in Yemen. Those are the first steps. And just a general statement that the U.S. will now set up a negotiation, we saw where that led in Syria. They've supposedly been negotiating while being actively involved now for many years, and the sanctions have continued and the efforts to stop rebuilding. So what does it mean in Yemen? I think we should use it as an opportunity to really demand that there be real life to this. What the U.S. has found is that they were unable, despite years of bombing, and this was really a U.S. war. It was never Saudi Arabia alone. It couldn't have lasted one day without U.S. technicians, U.S. aircraft, U.S. bombs, equipment, satellite reconnaissance, U.S. Navy blockade. All of this was a U.S. war. Will it really end? That's the question. And will Yemen have a chance to breathe a sigh of relief? Clearly, it didn't succeed. and a people's movement in Yemen has been able to survive and continue a resistance. And we should really salute that struggle and that determination, that resistance, because it shows that it's possible, even against massive bombardment of school buses and schools and hospitals and marketplaces and wedding parties. We should just think of the crimes of the past years.
Daniel Kovalik, that's an interesting point. Our guest in New York just brought up, if Biden is serious, here's a first step. Reverse the designation of Ansara as a terrorist organization. The UN and aid groups have called the designation to be reversed numerous times, warning that it would push Yemen into a large-scale famine and it would seriously impede humanitarian activities in Yemen. Do you think he'll reverse it?
Well, first of all, I agree that that has to be done immediately. I'm concerned that he has not done it yet. That would not take anything but for the State Department to reverse that. It can be done by fiat. You know, we don't need people to vote on it. Why hasn't he done it yet? So I don't know if he's going to do it, but I agree it has to be done, because once you declare – they've essentially declared the government of Yemen a terrorist organization, and what that means under binding Security Council resolutions, countries cannot trade with Yemen. They cannot do banking with Yemen. And so, as you know, the UN has raised the alarm that that designation will only deepen the worst humanitarian crisis the world has known since World War II.
Sarah Founders, reacting to the news of the U.S. president's comments, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. In other words, they want to see action. Why should they trust Washington? In fact, back in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Vice President Joe Biden, that gave Riyadh the support to carry out this war in the first place, as you mentioned also.
Well, it is heartening, their statement that they will not be fooled, because it means that they really understand deeply from the beginning this was a U.S. war. They know who they're up against. They have clear demands for how to end the siege and how to have legitimate negotiations, if that's what's on called for. But they also see through the Biden administration. There is a new cabinet, but they all, every single one of the people that Biden has named, are really war criminals in their threats against Iran for many years, and their war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Syria and in Libya and Yemen. So we shouldn't give any credence to Biden or Blinken in terms of the State Department. I think we need to continue real support for a people's movement and struggle in Yemen, and also show confidence they know who they're dealing with. So I thought that the response today, from the Supreme Military Council and from senior officials shows that they, as a political force, know who they're dealing with and are preparing next steps ahead. So it's a difficult time, because this will be used internationally. Biden is trying to position himself in a new way to continue war in the region.
Daniel Kovalik, should the Yemenis trust the United States?
No, of course not. I mean, the U.S. has, look at Vietnam was a famous case where, of course, at every moment we were about to win and pull out of Vietnam, when in fact it went on for many years. Same thing in Afghanistan, right? We're now 20 years into that war. Trump was actually trying to withdraw troops. It's clear that now Biden is going to stop that withdrawal. The U.S. cannot be trusted on this. I will say, though, that, one thing that gives me pause is whether, in fact, Biden does want to end some of the conflicts in the Middle East, because he has his sights on bigger game. For example, the very influential Atlantic Council just released a white paper urging Biden to engage in regime change in China. China clearly being a target of the Biden administration, and possibly Russia. So I agree with my colleague that, you know, whatever the result for Yemen, and obviously we want to see peace in Yemen, I think we have to be vigilant to see what Biden is going to do also in the rest of the world.
Ms. Founders, here's another perspective. Skeptics are saying that Biden is basically just sweet-talking right now, that he's an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, and he isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. Do you see it in that light as well?
I very much do. He is an old wolf, an old war criminal. Let's really say who he is. The staunchest supporter of the U.S. war in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and Yemen. And even Blinken in the confirmation hearing said, well, we have to relook at sanctions so they give the greatest pain. Those are his words. A conscious understanding. These are really criminal forces within U.S. policy. But I do so much agree with Dan. They are trying to reposition themselves on how they can really focus attention on China, on Russia, on Iran. And so can they reposition themselves with forces here in the U.S. to disarm the movement here? Can they reposition themselves with European forces, EU, and some of the NATO forces? Can they put a new look on their wars? That's what they're attempting to do. And at the same time, they are going full steam ahead to make new threats on the world. It's a very dangerous time because clearly the U.S. Economic position is weakening, and their ability to impose their will on the world has been severely challenged. But again, we should really applaud the struggle in Yemen for surviving these difficult years and as a cohesive force with an understanding of what they're up against.
Daniel Kovalev, let's get your thoughts on the matter as well. Do you think that Joe Biden, he's not one to let the likes of the Saudis down, is he?
No, of course not, and he's made that clear. He made it clear publicly, and he also talked to the Saudis before making this announcement, making it clear that the announcement was not going to affect U.S.-Saudi relationships. So clearly, Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, continue, it looks like, Trump's policies towards Israel. We just saw that the Senate, for example, unanimously approved to continue the U.S.'s embassy to Israel in Jerusalem, for example. I think he will continue those policies. I think what you're going to see is, you know, at least on its face, a kinder, gentler leader of imperialism. But that does not mean it's any less aggressive or cruel. In fact, Intercept recently reminded us that the CIA, in an internal document, thought Obama was the best leader for the United States because, you know, the world and Americans interested in peace trusted him. And so he was able to get away with things, including the war in Libya, that other presidents could not. And I think Biden will do the same. I mean, the irony of Trump is that while he was coarse and he was poorly spoken and he was openly racist, which are all bad things, he showed the true face of American imperialism, and that was actually a good thing. And I think the world woke up a bit, and Biden is hoping the world's going to go back to sleep.
Sarah Flounders, the reversing of this policy, it definitely is a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, which has been a long time a U.S. Strategic ally. If Biden's position or the U.S.'s position isn't going to change too much, with regards to Riyadh, then what kind of message is this sending to the Saudis?
Well, it's really sending them a message that there's going to be some new positioning, but there's no pullback in military assistance or in diplomatic political support. So the message is, you know, we're changing the game a bit. Don't worry too much. The U.S. well knows how to drag negotiations on for years and make demand after demand on the forces that they're negotiating with. Clearly, they want to demand and try to divide the movement in Yemen. That's their first goal in opening negotiations, who they speak to, who they're speaking to on one ear and then the other. They, of course, want to weaken and undermine the position of Iran in the region. And so there's a lot that Saudi Arabia is a real pillar, absolutely, of U.S. Domination and control in the region, but it is a pillar, you know, based on sand. It's a completely corrupt regime held in the hands of one family with seething discontent below. So, you know, they may be looking for ways even to shore up and get Saudi Arabia out of a very difficult position by more actively engaging in negotiations and not just sitting next to them at the bomb control missions, which is what they've been doing, not just servicing the planes militarily, but intervening more politically with the regime. So, but that's not an effort of liberation at all. It's not an effort at human rights for anyone in the region ever.
Daniel, let's hit rewind here for a second. On the campaign trail for the presidency, Joe Biden said that he would punish Saudi leaders for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, adding that he believed the order was given by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He said, and I quote, "We will in fact make them the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." I'd like to get your thoughts on those comments made by Joe Biden. Should Riyadh start to worry a little bit if Biden is to keep his election campaign promises?
First of all, I would agree that Riyadh should be punished for these things, particularly the war in Yemen, which is, in my belief, a genocidal war, which has already destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives, destroyed, you know, countless UNESCO historic sites. But I don't believe that Biden will do that. I think it's clear he won't. I think if he was going to do that, he would have signaled it. I think that is clearly a promise he is going to back off of.
And Ms. Flounders, your thoughts on that issue as well. We've got probably less than 30 seconds to get your final thoughts.
Yeah, I very much agree. Biden said a lot of things during his campaign, and so far, he's falling short on every single one of them. You know, politicians make campaign promises, and then there's a reality of the institution that they represent, which is U.S. imperialism. They want to continue that domination, and at great cost to the people of the world and the people right here at home. So I wouldn't trust one
promise. All right,
thanks
a lot. Allow me to thank my guests. Author of No More War, Daniel Cavallo, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to author and activist Sarah Flounder speaking to us from New York. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Khamenei. women, pioneers of the Islamic Revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the seventh day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Whenever the goals and ideals of the Islamic Revolution are exposed to threats, women enter the scene of struggles alongside men and prove that the Iranian woman firmly sticks to her covenant with the revolution and the ideals of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. Women have proved their potentials in various fields beside men. For the past year that coronavirus has spread all over the world, Iranian women have proven their self-sacrifice by rushing to take care and cure patients. Some of them have even delayed their marriage to help the patients. One of the outstanding scenes of selfless efforts was that Fatemeh Mukhbir, daughter of the headquarters for execution of Imam Khomeini's order, volunteered for getting coronavirus jabs. One of the honorable scenes of self-sacrifice and patience was shown by the wife of the prominent nuclear scientist, martyr Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who said that she would continue the path of her husband, although she had been alongside her husband and seen his assassination. Let us move 1 year back. Last year, the U.S. Terrorist Army, upon the direct order of the former President Donald Trump, targeted the champion of fight against terrorism, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and killed him and the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, together with eight of their companions near Baghdad airport. The Americans thought that the move could stop the movement of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance axis, but martyr Soleimani's daughters Fatima and Zainab stood firmly and announced that they would continue their father's path. Moreover, Zainab took the responsibility of the foundation of Martyr Soleimani's school. Women have undoubtedly played a very important role in the course of the Islamic Revolution. They have shown the culmination of awareness, commitment, steadfastness, and loyalty. These women have participated in cultural, social, political, educational, and economic scenes to help advance the Islamic Revolution. The founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, explained the role of women in the first month after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In early March 1979, he said, "You women prove that you are in the forefront. You prove that you are ahead of men. Men are inspired by you. Iran's men have been admonished by women and learned lessons from them." The historic role of men and women in defense of their religion and land is originated in the Islamic culture. Although women have been excluded from armed battle in Islam, they can take part in other aspects of struggle. As a matter of fact, the role of women behind the battlefront cannot be ignored. During the eight-year imposed war, too, women participated in various fields to support the combatants. Many of them worked as doctors and nurses, and hundreds of thousands of them were active in cities in logistics and preparations for the fronts. This took place in the era of Prophet of Islam too. Women like Nasibe and Atiyeh participated in many of the battles as nurses and assistants. All Muslim ladies have learned these lessons of self-sacrifice from Lady Khadija, Lady Fatima, and Lady Zainab, who spent their life to support Islamic values and ideals. Furthermore, they encouraged their men to go to the war theaters. Imam Khomeini said on these women, "This is the light of faith that you ladies are not scared of martyrdom. Our youths and our men and women are ready for martyrdom. Women are builders of human beings. That's why the domineering system has tried its utmost to deprive them of this role through myriads of stratagems. This system has tried to plunge women in sexuality and corruption through exposure of their beauties to paralyze nations." Contrary to the corrupt wishes of the domineering system led by the U.S., the mothers of martyrs have tried to immortalize their martyrs through keeping the love of God alive among masses. As soon as they heard the news of martyrdom of their sons, they would thank God and appeal to God to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers buried their sons themselves. The presence of Muslim ladies in various scenes of the Islamic Revolution has taught the women of other nations and dumbfounded the ill-wishers. A French female reporter wrote in her memoirs of the first year of the revolution, "In Iran, everyone is striving within a great socio-political development to build the structure of an Islamic government. Meanwhile, what is notable more than anything else is the steadfastness and inexhaustibility of women alongside men."